Thanks then, everyone, for joining us for the March Football Scholars Forum session, where we're trying a new idea out where we can report to each other on the state of the field. And we've called for volunteers from our community to present either a book or a long-form article to the rest of the community. And we'll go in groups of three, and then we'll leave a little bit of time for discussion between them. But the focus of this session is to mainly report to one another about how we've found the books that we've selected for the session. So we'll go ahead in order of the people that signed up to present books, and we'll start off with Peter Leggi. And just again as a reminder, if we can keep this to 5 minutes apiece, then we'll have plenty of time to have some remarks between the groups of three that present. So Peter, when you're ready, take it away with Fearing Loathing in La Liga.
Alex, you're the first on the list, though.
I am the first on the list, so we will go first then with Los Clubes en la Ciudad de Buenos Aires.
Before you begin, just a hello to everyone, and to remind folks to mute their microphones when they're not speaking, and also that we are live tweeting the session at hashtag FSFMarch. So follow, there's a back channel conversation going on there as well. So back to you, Alex, in Buenos Aires.
Fantastic. So I picked for today a book by a friend and sociologist here in Argentina whose name is Rodrigo Dascal. And we last heard from Rodrigo in a session on the Football Scholars Forum, I think in the first year of our existence. So he's written a book recently, and the name of the book is Los Clubes en la Ciudad de Buenos Aires, 1932 to 1945. Revista La Cancha, Sociabilidad, Política y Estado. So translation is Clubs of Buenos Aires during this time period, 32 to 45. The magazine is called La Cancha, and it's about sociability, politics, and the state. And what's interesting about this book is that Rodrigo got a grant at the National Library to write a book about one of their special holdings, which is this magazine, La Cancha. And the book is really about using the magazine to explain the role that soccer clubs played in shaping urban sociability and the city's physical fabric. So La Cancha is a magazine that not only covered the obvious results and stars of professional soccer during this period, but it also gave a lot of attention to the internal life of the club and politics within the clubs. So many of these political side of club dealings would be around lobbying the state to provide help for constructing stadiums. And another thing that the magazine focuses on is the impact of the club's social and physical infrastructure on surrounding neighborhoods. So there's articles about how something that club has built in a neighborhood affects how people are using it. The book has 10 chapters, and it focuses on, each of those chapters focuses on a theme. So some are much shorter than others. There's a chapter exclusively about violence in this time period, which kind of demonstrates the long continuity that violence has in soccer. And I think this book is really interesting for urban scholars in general, because it really does provide a lot of material on the link between a stadium and neighborhood life. So it's particularly useful in understanding sport in general and urban life, because while much of the magazine is covering soccer, it's also covering all the other activities that the club offers, which include things like social clubs, cultural activities, other sports, of course, carnival dances, things like this. The book also details how clubs received support from the state and the municipality. Both the federal and city level of governments were involved in donating property and providing subsidies for stadium construction and also smaller infrastructure, kids' playgrounds, sports annexes close to the stadiums. And I found really the most interesting part of the book to be the first four chapters, because it focuses on the expansion of clubs in the 1930s and how the expansion of these clubs in the wider urban area served as poles for the expansion of Buenos Aires in general. So each of these clubs sometimes anchored a new area of development in the city that then had social life surrounding that pole rather than everyone having to come to the center for their social and cultural consumption. So just a brief mention of what clubs Dascal is talking about. Huracán, Boca Juniors, and Vélez Sarsfield are ones that he found large sections of the magazine honing in on stories about construction at those clubs, so he gets to kind of delve into those with some detail. And I found another really interesting section to be the 6th and 7th chapters, which talks all about the social and cultural life of the clubs. So this is dances and social events and involvement in elections in club politics as the club directorship had to be renewed every certain number of years in accordance with the club statutes. And here in these chapters, he focuses on some clubs that are not the large clubs, the Bocas, the Vélez, the Rivers of Buenos Aires, but on what's called clubes de barrio, small neighborhood clubs. And these clubs in the magazine really focuses on them as bastions of values, of what they see professional soccer sometimes eroding. So you already get a tension between these small clubs that are identified as bastions of values and the larger ones that are forgetting their kind of public debt to a wider community. One of the book's both its strength and its weaknesses, it is focused on one source. It is a shorter book, and it is exclusively about La Cancha, but I think it's a very valuable addition to a very detailed look at the link between neighborhood life, stadium construction, and the social events that tend to circulate around the clubs of Buenos Aires. That's all for me. So we can move on to Peter.
Great. Thanks, Alex. Sounds like a good complement to what you're doing down there in Buenos Aires in terms of covering an earlier period, right, compared to yours.
Yeah, absolutely. It's proven very useful as a model.
Okay. I've posted my review of Fear and Loathing in La Liga, Barcelona versus Real Madrid, on my blog. So if you go to footballiscominghome.info, you can read it in detail. I've also put a link on the Football Scholars site. I sort of conspired to cover this book at this time because I knew that the Clásico was scheduled for just a couple of days before the forum. And it was an incredible game. So it's a perfect time to review this history of the rivalry between Barça and Real Madrid. Sid Lowe, as probably everybody in this group knows, is a well-known football journalist who writes mainly about Spanish football for The Guardian and other major media outlets. Not many people know that he also has a PhD in history from the University of Sheffield with a thesis on the Spanish Civil War, particularly the Juventud de Acción Popular in the years 1932 to 1937. It's a book that's full of great footballogical facts and statistics. But for me, probably the most revealing part of the journey in reading this book came from the author's analysis and contextualization of the rivalry's sort of wider dynamics, particularly the social and political dynamics. And I like the way in which the author brought his academic training, particularly as a historian, to bear on the book. And he did this in a number of ways. The first way is the nicely chronological architecture of the book, which makes it, I think, quite appealing. But also the rich and diverse sources that he uses, including government documents, minutes of the meetings of the clubs, newspaper archives, newsreels, and many, many oral interviews with older protagonists, with famous players and coaches and club directors. A third way in which you can see the academic training coming through is that, again, the football rivalry on the pitch is situated in the context of a changing Spain. And the fourth and final point I wanted to raise is that I think Sid Lowe goes really well beyond the simple binaries you often read in kind of journalistic accounts of the Barça-Real rivalry, which basically reduce it to a kind of Spain versus Catalonia, or to use Lowe's words, quote, Madrid, fascists. Barça, civil war losers. Madrid, civil war victors and repressors. Barça left. Madrid, right. Barca good, Madrid bad. And the way that he tells the story is really through a series of potted biographies that are really nice to complicate these binaries, these dichotomies, and to humanize the story as well. Two of my favorite chapters are in the early part of the book when he has one on the Barca president Josep Suñol, aka the martyr president, and then another one on Rafael Sanchez Guerra, the forgotten president. And basically, in these chapters, Lowe debunks a good chunk of the political mythology of Barcelona and also reminds us that Madrid was where the civil war was fought and not Barcelona. And he argues persuasively that Franco's forces murdered Suñol not because he was Barca's president, quote, but because he accidentally crossed the front line and represented the Republic, end quote. The story of Madrid's liberal president is also really interesting because he was arrested and tried by the Franco regime, and it's a useful counterpoint to the better-known role of Santiago Bernabeu, the right-wing patriarch of Real Madrid during the Franco era. One of my favorite parts of the book is the part on the 1950s, which was really a golden era for both Barça and Real Madrid, but also for the rivalry itself. This is the years when they take advantage of the new Bernabeu Stadium, the construction of the Camp Nou, and also the two foreign superstars that come to lead both teams. One is Laszlo Kubala from Hungary, joining Barca, and then Alfredo Di Stefano, of course, from Argentina, who joins Real Madrid. And one of the book's revelations gets at one of the central issues in the rivalry, which is how did Di Stefano come to sign for Real Madrid? It was almost certain that he was going to be joining the Azulgrana. And Lowe looks at all this different evidence, and he basically makes a good argument that it was as much Barca's dithering and doubt that kept Di Stefano from joining Barcelona as it was the pressure from the Franco regime. And, this is historic because, of course, Di Stefano joins Real Madrid and they go on to win the first five European Cups. The book then goes on to detail the kind of long 1960s, which were a bit of a dark period. And, this is the period remembered when Real Madrid becomes kind of a team of cultural ambassadors for the regime. Though Sid Lowe points out, the players really had little to say in this. And also, it's the era marked by the infamous episode of Guruceta, the referee who, in a quarterfinal of the Copa del Generalissimo, awards Madrid an extremely dubious penalty that ends up eliminating Barcelona, the hosts, and 30,000 cushions are thrown onto the pitch at Camp Nou. And Lowe writes, Guruceta became Catalan's shorthand for every referee in Spain, shorthand for injustice. For some, he had become shorthand for the football authorities, for Real Madrid, and for the dictatorship. The second half of the book opens with, of course, the arrival of Cruyff at Camp Nou and the demise of the Franco regime. I don't have a lot of time to get into the details, but it's interesting that Lowe points out that Cruyff's debut coincided with the appearance of Barca's now famous slogan, Més que un club, more than a club. It's actually now trademarked. And Lowe thinks this did not feel entirely coincidental, football, politics, and culture converging. The final third of the book covers the more recent period, from roughly the early 1990s to the present. It focuses on how and why Barcelona and Madrid came to dominate the European game after 1998. And what I noticed about this section, it's written in a markedly different style. It's much more journalistic and I think less original in its analysis. I think it's almost always more difficult for historians to write about contemporary events. And also, avid readers like us have had the chance of reading Phil Ball, of reading Jimmy Burns. Last but not least, we've also had access to satellite television, to the internet, and so we've been able to follow the Clásico's recent history on and off the pitch. Nevertheless, Lowe's 406-page book saves some juicy insights for the very end, as it considers the impact of the Galácticos, the special one, and the cantera versus cartera approaches to developing young players. That is to say, training them, like in the Barcelona Academy at La Masia, versus buying them, as well as how Spain's international success has changed the Barcelona-Real Madrid rivalry and Spanish fans' sense of nationhood. So with our memories of Barcelona's operatic 4-3 comeback victory at the Bernabeu on Sunday still fresh and raw, let's not get too melancholy or nostalgic. As the closing passage of the book puts it, quote, Real Madrid and Barcelona FC will meet again, and when they do, the case will be the most impressive in the game. Tickets will sell out in hours, and millions will gather in front of television screens across the world, more than for any other club match anywhere. And on the morning of the game, they will still be there clutching flowers, pleading for victory. Once more into the fray. Life in 90 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. That's great. I'll just add that my hatred for Sergio Ramos is longstanding and only grew after the last Clásico. But we'll look forward to the next one. How about Melissa next? Melissa, you might still be muted.
Yeah.
There you go.
You just went out for a minute, so I wasn't sure if you were ready. So, I actually was flying back from the West Coast and hadn't planned my ticket correctly. I think it's the first time I haven't watched a Clásico live in about 10 years. And I stayed up until 1:30 a.m. East Coast time, even though I was teaching the next morning to watch it. So it's definitely an important game. So the book that I did a review of, Gabriel Kuhn, Soccer versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics, I think it's a really timely and passionate contribution to this public discussion of the politics of sport. And I think thinking about it in the context of the protests in Brazil last summer, the upcoming World Cup, the issues of immigrant workers in Qatar, all of these things, I think this book is a very nice sort of analysis of radical politics within the game. So not just the politics of sport, but radical politics within the game. And so Kuhn is a former semi-professional player and also community activist. And I think that actually gives him a unique perspective writing this book. And one of the nice things that he does, I think, is despite, you know, dwelling on the negative state of affairs, he does talk about resistance both inside and outside the professional game, and his ultimate argument is that joy and pleasure still come before the commercialization of the sport. So the book itself is separated into three different chapters on these resistance efforts. And he begins with a very brief history. I would say, you know, there are plenty of other books that do more justice to the history of the game. But his is really, I think, set up to try to dispel some of the myths around class politics. So truths and myths about football as working class sport. And as he says, while the majority of footballers might still have working class backgrounds, and he talks a bit about contracting players from the global south to the global north and issues with that. So he says, quote, it is problematic to claim that the rapid commercialization of the game during the last decades has stolen the game from the workers. The game was never fully theirs. So what he's focusing on instead is how recent changes have limited working class people's roles to entertainers and consumers. And then he delves into current resistance to this dynamic. So radical debates on football, radical intervention in the professional game, and alternative football culture. The radical debate section, he begins by talking about what he sees as five key political arguments marshaled against it. And those are the opiate of the masses argument, nationalism, sectarianism, fan violence, commercialization, and bigotry. And he acknowledges the validity of each argument while at the same time exposing the limits. So, for example, while fan violence is a very real problem, he says opponents tend to overstate how widespread it is. Or, for example, nationalism, sectarianism, while that is a real problem, he also shows international effort. So trying to say that, yes, these are valid arguments, but there are also efforts in the other direction. And so for his, he argues that, quote, the solution is not to fight football, but to fight a power structure that relies on mass control and distraction. And so then he builds on that contention in the next two sections. Within the professional game, he identifies five areas of intervention: protests, social justice campaigns, personalities, or individuals using their status for social change, teams themselves making political statement, and supporters groups. Most of the attention in this section is focused on the complexity of the politics of supporters groups and ultras. So he focuses on the inroads that they've made into changing football culture, but at the same time acknowledges that the politics of many groups, while they may seem to be against or seem to coincide at times with radical politics or left-wing politics, at the same time most ultra groups seem more apolitical. But at the same time, he does talk about their extensive and impressive DIY supporters culture network, and actually sees this as an area for perhaps some kind of inroads into campaigns that might have inroads into these supporters groups. The next part is on alternative football culture. It's a shorter section, but I think equally important, and I will confess that I've been involved in two of the things that he talks about in terms of this grassroots and underground football culture. So he focuses on particular groups, grassroots tournaments, and then football for radicals. In this section, his narrative is actually quite limited, and he includes a lot of interviews with different groups, articles that they have written. So really actually letting people talk for themselves, reprinting things. So it's actually a little bit more about what's going on from those people's point of view. And as he said, that football can be important to bring people together, and, quote, while football may not be revolutionary per se, it can be part of the revolution. And the other thing, I like some of these quotes, so I'll say a few more, is soccer fans have done much more to open borders, to create international alliances, and to overcome prejudice and bigotry than what both the tabloids and cranky leftist soccer critics want to make us believe. One of the things mentioned in here that I was involved with is bringing tours of English soccer players to Zapatista communities in Chiapas. So there's some hope there. And then at the end, he quotes Antonio Negri, "I enjoy making revolution, I enjoy going to football." It's not an academic text, but I think it's well argued and substantiated. So he does draw on scholarship and personal experience, interviews, news articles. The appendix is really information rich. There's a great amount of images. The selection of images are really good, but it's also a weakness. I think the layout that was chosen for the book can at times disrupt his narrative. Things are interspersed that, you know, there might be an interview with someone else that cuts apart his narrative. So I think in some ways it's almost easier to read as sort of separate texts at the same time. But I think it's a really good contribution to the ongoing discussion of sports and politics. And then his own experiences, I think, really would make this book appeal to a diverse audience. So I would say it's great.
Excellent. I got a message from Alex saying his cafe in Buenos Aires just got noisy. I think they're going to kick the crap out of him again. But no, all joking aside, I'll take over the transition right now. A couple of questions, perhaps, before we move on to the next three. Anybody have questions about the reports or the books?
Yes. Hi, can you hear me? This is Alon.
Yes, Alon. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I had two questions for Alex. Curious to know, since so many of the Argentinian teams and also in Uruguay and other places in Latin America had origins in socialist, communist, anarchist groups, I was wondering if that was still, if you saw that influence still in the 30s to the 40s. And then you also mentioned violence, and I wonder, you know, how that violence was interpreted at the time. what were the causes. Also, I wanted to say that about the last book, Gabriel's book, Gabriel Kunz, I found that book very informative. I wrote recently the entry on football and revolution for a new anthology about sports and revolution. And that was a book I looked at. I guess my only critique, besides the structure, which was a little bit, you know, it wasn't straightforward. It kind of jumped back and forth between personal stories, history, which was fine, is that, and again, you know, I know you can't include every section in every country in the world, but, and he did, you know, talk a lot about Latin America, Europe, but I'm always sensitive when Asia is missing and when, you know, Australia, the Middle East, of course, and those regions have had also a long tradition of connecting politics and football. And even in India in the 30s, I mean, football clubs were one of the centers of nationalist feelings and organizing, and the same thing in Turkey, Egypt, and so forth. So I guess I'm a little sensitive when those areas are missing suddenly. But I enjoyed all the reviews. All of them were excellent. So thank you.
Okay, Alex, just quickly a response so we can get to the next three.
Sure. Response to the first question is, while many of the clubs that are mentioned in La Cancha have founding groups that are... Alan, could you make sure to mute your mic?
Sorry.
Thank you. While many of these clubs are founded with explicitly political identities, by the 1930s, they absolutely still exist, but we see the beginnings of something that continues to this day, which is clubs becoming, filling their directorships with people from different political parties so that they can benefit from the changing political tides of the national situation. So they're not as explicitly political as one might expect, even though even their names are referring to explicitly political things like Haymarket Martyrs or referencing Chicago. The second question about violence and what it's reflecting in La Cancha and Rodrigo's book, it's mainly about a decaying state of soccer. Sometimes it takes on some allusions to the professionalization of the game and that being the cause of the corruption and just overall poor morality that's on display. But just and something else I want to say real quickly about the first question. We're producing now and should be out next year a book on Peronism's influence on different clubs. It's going to be an edited volume. And in that book and in a lot of the investigations people are doing that, you will see much more detail on the politics of clubs and the foundational politics, particularly some clubs conflicting with Peronism and Peronism's subsidies for many clubs and what cost that has for a lot of clubs. That's all for me.
Great, thank you. Melissa, you have a follow-up comment. Briefly, please.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I actually wrote a review of this, and that was one of my critiques about the fact that although he frames it as a global analysis, most of it does actually center on Europe with a few examples. And one of the things I was going to say is I think that is one of the things that we struggle with as researchers in terms of studying globalization is how do we use case studies, micro histories, in this book, it ends up being a macro analysis, which becomes very Eurocentric. So I do think that's maybe open for doing more. People can do more research in different ways.
Excellent. Javier in Ann Arbor, you wanted to intervene.
Hey, just a quick question for you, Pete. The book I'm presenting covers in full detail the presence of Spanish clubs in Mexico, especially during and after the Civil War. And there is a lot of Catalan refugees in Mexico, but there is not a single Catalan soccer team. The Basque people have their soccer teams. People from Asturias have their teams. People from other regions in Spain have their team, but not people from Catalonia. And I wanted to ask you, you get a sense from the book you're reviewing, at which point the Barcelona became a symbol for Catalan nationalism, and at which point they started use Catalan as their official as the official language of the club.
Fairly early on, if I remember correctly, but I don't want to put my foot in my mouth and say something totally incorrect, but the association between the club and Catalan nationalist sentiments is established fairly early on. So let me double check, because it's full of facts, many of which, you know, especially in the early period, I'm not super familiar with. And then when did the language become the official language? Also, I'm not fully certain about, but I do remember that, of course, when Franco comes in, there's a very determined effort to stamp out both the Catalonian language and any presence of Catalonian nationalists in the board. That's what I'm comfortable sharing at this point. Let me go back and look and see if I can come up with a better answer for you, and I'll let you know. Okay, cool. Let's move to the next three and keep the conversation going, because the clock is ticking here. David Kilpatrick, Andrew Guest, and Brian Van Wyk come next. Let's start with David, please.
Well, hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? I chose Summer of 67 by Ian Thompson. The full title is Summer of 67, Flower Power, Race Riots, Vietnam, and the Greatest Soccer Final Played on American Soil. I like to just call this book Soccer in the Summer of Love, and that really is what it is about. In the aftermath of the 1966 final, which was broadcast tape delayed in the United States on NBC to an audience in America of 9 million, a lot of investors saw dollar signs associated with association code football. And a former baseball owner named Bill Cox had this outlaw league called the International Soccer League. But he had gotten some other people to invest with him and put together a league that was to start in 1967 called the NPSL, or National Professional Soccer League. Meanwhile, another group of investors put together what they wanted to call the North American Soccer League. So we had a situation in the United States of two professional leagues starting up at exactly the same time. To avoid branding confusion, the proposed NASL forged forward as the United Soccer Association, and both leagues continued talks throughout 1967, but one league was sanctioned by the United States Soccer Federation and the other was not. But the two leagues were very different. And Thompson focuses primarily on the United Soccer Association, or USA, which was the sanctioned league. What's pretty interesting about that is that the two leagues were very, very different in their business models. The USA sanctioned league was, oddly enough, a league of imported teams. So the team playing in Washington, D.C., as the Washington Whips, were really Aberdeen of Scotland. The New York team, the Skyliners, were really Cerro of Uruguay. The Detroit Cougars were Glentoran of Northern Ireland. Toronto City were really Hibernian of Scotland. The Boston Shamrock Rovers were the Shamrock Rovers of the Republic of Ireland. The Cleveland Stokers were Stoke City of England, who were every bit as thuggish then as they're known to be now. Some things seem to never change. And the San Francisco Golden Gate Gales were Adio Den Haag of the Netherlands. Houston Stars were Bango of Brazil. The Chicago Mustangs were Cagliari of Italy. The Dallas Tornado were Dundee United. The Vancouver Royal Canadiens were Sunderland of England. And the Los Angeles Wolves were Wolverhampton Wanderers. So Thompson traces that league out week by week by week, with some reference to the alternate circuit, which was going on in five of the same markets. So in other words, Baltimore had a team, while DC did. Two teams were playing out of Yankee Stadium. two teams are playing in Toronto, two teams are playing in Chicago, and two in LA. So there's a lot of confusion in the book, and that can be a little bit tricky as you go through. But Thompson does a good job of telling the story of each match, and then some of the stories he tells off the pitch are every bit as fascinating, if not more so, as the players from other countries had a heck of a wild time in the Summer of Love in the United States, encountering different celebrities and things like that, as the entrepreneurs tried to have soccer catch on in the United States. What's interesting about the writing of the book is that Thompson is an expat from Scotland himself and an Aberdeen supporter. And the genesis of the book was him going to a Major League Soccer game to see DC United play and realizing that his beloved team back home had played there as the home team back in 67. And that was how his research project started. From my perspective on it, I've long been fascinated by 67, but I have a much more New York-centric focus. So it was really interesting to me to see how he portrays the New York Skyliners, the team that was owned by Madison Square Garden. I've been much more interested over the years in the New York Generals, the team owned by RKO General. Both teams shared Yankee Stadium. Thompson does a great job of you know, teasing out what it was like for these players in that kind of environment and the problems facing two different leagues competing at the same time and eventually merging. And that's what happened with, say, the New York teams. The Skyliners simply merged with the Generals as the two rival factions agreed to get along and eventually formed the North American Soccer League in 68. What's really a treat towards the end of this is the final itself of the USA, which was played between Thompson's beloved Aberdeen / Washington Whips and the Los Angeles Wolves / Wolverhampton Wanderers at the Los Angeles Coliseum. And it went into added time and was won by the LA Wolves 6-5 on an own goal. The person that sent the cross in was a former coach of mine as a kid, recently passed away, Bobby Thompson. When he was with Wolves, he sent the cross in. And Thompson gives great detail over the final. And each one of the games throughout the entire year. But also he places it in the greater context of the social upheaval that was facing America. And not just America, as military engagement with Vietnam was amped up and street protests began and psychedelic experimentation was catching the counterculture, having it explode, but also placing the events of the year in the context of what was happening in the Middle East and things like that. So it's a really rich text. It takes a snapshot of the United States and soccer at the time as people were trying to capitalize on the interest in the 66 World Cup final. And while none of the teams that started then are in place now, we learn an awful lot along the way, even in terms of why Dundee United wear their tangerine kits. It actually started from Lamar Hunt, owner of the Dallas Tornado, having them wear orange shirts. So the long-time effects of that experiment in 67 are teased out as well by the conclusion for Thompson, and it's really just a real treat of a book, and I strongly recommend it for everyone.
Excellent. Thank you, David. Andrew Guest, next.
Okay. So, yeah, I wrote on the Google Doc that I was interested. It's not the state of the field, contemporary speaking, but with the World Cup coming up, I'm going to be teaching an undergraduate class for kids who really don't have any background in any kind of systematic study of soccer or football, but just to take advantage of the World Cup. You might call it a boondoggle on my part. We'll be doing lots of match analysis, quote-unquote. But the I've always been curious about this Soccer Madness book, subtitled Brazil's Passion for the World's Most Popular Sport by a sociologist named Janet Lever, is published a fair while ago. The original version was published in 1983 by the University of Chicago Press, which made me think it must have had some chops at some point, and then reprinted in 1995 after the World Cup in the U.S. By another press, by Waveland Press. So I've kind of known about it for a while as one of the few sort of purely sociological takes from a North American perspective on football culture in one country or one nation. But I never had a chance to dive into it, and I was sort of curious whether it held up coming up to the World Cup. Just with the World Cup in Brazil, it seemed like the obvious thing to look at. I also would note, if anybody has suggestions for readings, the course is being put together, and I'm trying to figure that out. I'm not a Latin Americanist, so it's going to be a curious mix of things, but it'll be from a sociological perspective and a little bit of a psychological perspective too, sort of the social psychology of fandom. But I know that David Goldblatt has a book coming out about soccer in Brazil, and I think Dave Zirin has one about the sort of politics of mega events focusing on Brazil and the World Cup and the Olympics. So I'm excited to see those, but they aren't coming out until right before the World Cup. I was curious about sort of the story behind it, and I was looking up some context, and I actually stumbled across a review in the Bulletin of Latin American Research by John Humphrey and Alan Tomlinson, some British sport studies folks, and I thought their take on it was interesting. It actually gives a nice, I think, sort of amusing quote. It's not nice, actually. It's quite a harsh review, but let me just read a brief bit here because I think people might find it amusing. They say, quote, "Janet Lever had a clear opportunity to score a winner with this book. The goal was wide open, just waiting for the ball. Preparation and service from the rest of the team were hardly lacking. Lever visited Brazil on numerous occasions from 1967 onwards and spent 13 months there in 1972 and 1973. This was followed by teaching experience in various North American universities and further collaboration research in the United States on sport and society. In Brazil itself, the author appears to have been fortunate and industrious in establishing contacts. The text displays a high degree of access to influential figures in Brazilian footballing worlds. But in spite of this, Lever's book manages to tell us very little of use about Brazilian football. Instead of tapping the ball into the net, the author balloons it over the bar from very close range indeed." Mostly I just thought that was kind of funny. I think they're a little harsh. I know what they're saying. I do think the book has potential use for undergraduates. It's reasonably well written. It's fairly short. And it really is testing a sociological thesis. It's essentially making the argument that sport anywhere serves a function of simultaneously uniting and dividing. And it's a very kind of functionalist sociological take. And Brazil is just sort of her test case. In fact, there's not much about Brazil at all in the first couple chapters. So it's really laying out the kind of broad sociological ground. And I think it does it in a way that, again, is accessible to undergrads, but not necessarily super sophisticated. I kind of, as I was just briefly researching this online, I learned that Lever had been a sociologist at Northwestern, but got denied tenure largely because they decided this book was not of sufficient merit. And she went on to become a sociologist, looking at relationships and sex. So one of her later books is one that amused me also. I suspect would not be of much interest to the Football Scholars Forum. One of her later books is titled The Great Sex Weekend, a 48-hour guide to rekindling sparks for bold, busy, or bored lovers. So she obviously went a somewhat different direction with things. There are some interesting tidbits in the book. I think she apparently got to know Pelé a little bit and kind of became friends with him, and she's got little bits in there about the Pelé and the cosmos. And including some of the stuff, like she argues that the Cosmos, Pelé's experience with the Cosmos actually really accelerated the commercialization of Brazilian football. So she gives the example of the Pelé's farewell testimonial game between Santos and the Cosmos, where apparently a lot of Brazilian radio stations sent media teams to cover the game, and they were just shocked to find that the Cosmos wanted to charge them for broadcasting rights. And it led to this huge battle because they just thought this should be free, and but good old American capitalism told them you can't do it that way, and she kind of argues that planted a seed. Her general hypothesis, I think, again, is interesting at a broad level in terms of how sport works. I don't think it would be a revelation to anybody here. I think it misses some of the complexity and some of the local nature of how soccer matters and its integration with politics and culture and history and all that, those kinds of things. And she also has some major omissions. She deals very briefly with social class, but not much. She deals very briefly with the, at the time, almost complete exclusion of women from football in Brazil, but again, only very briefly. So in terms of her thesis of kind of football as a uniting force, I think there's some significant pieces missing, but again, not without some interesting tidbits. It does kind of leave me, the big question, and this is sort of what Humphrey and Tomlinson were arguing in their review, their 1986 review, that it's such an obvious topic, you know, football in Brazil as a something of sociological significance. And it strikes me that in general these days there still are, you know, there's a lot of good now sort of social histories, and there also are a lot of good journalistic takes. But I don't see a lot of kind of purely sociological analyses, kind of ethnographic takes from a more academic standpoint on soccer culture in and how it relates to broader social and cultural and even psychological norms in a country, which is just curious. You know, this is she was trying to do this 30 years ago, may not have done it super well, but you know, why has no North American sociologist tried this again? It's kind of curious to me, either in Brazil or elsewhere. So that's where it left me. Again, there's lots of other bits in there. She does some surveying that I think was not particularly methodologically sound, but she also does a lot of interviews, and it does have some interesting tidbits, and it gives some good history. I shouldn't say good history. It gives a interesting snapshot of a particular historical period, very much from a North American perspective. I mean, some of it is the kind of classic 1980s, like explaining how soccer works to an American audience, which I think is now largely moot. But I'll probably leave it at that, although I'd be happy to discuss further if anybody's curious. And thanks. I see a lot of suggestions up here online. I am looking forward to the ones that are coming out right before the World Cup. I hope I just have time to get them into the class.
Thanks, Andrew. And I think the format of this session lends itself to using the chat function for some questions, quick dialogue, and some bibliographic references, too, because we only have about 35 minutes left, roughly. So next is Brian Van Wyk, right, here in East Lansing.
Yes. I will try to move along quickly, both because I want to save time, but also because I want to get back to Borussia Dortmund Schalke match right now. So I chose the book, The Ball is Colorful, which is a play on a quotation by Sepp Herberger, the famous German trainer, the architect of the Miracle of Bern in 1954. So in discussions of the history of German football, the success of Die Mannschaft at the 2010 World Cup is often presented as a unique watershed moment. The German team, which was the youngest in the tournament, lost to Spain in the semifinals, but played an exciting, attacking brand of football, in my opinion, thanks in no small part to losing the plotting Michael Ballack to injury before the tournament. commentators in Germany, including Chancellor Angela Merkel herself, attributed the team's appealing style to its multicultural character. This, in many ways, echoed discussions of the 1998 French World Cup winning side, as 12 of the 24 national team members were either born in another country or were the children of immigrants themselves. This idea that football, by its very nature, helps foster, quote, peaceful cooperation of people with different memberships in a multicultural Germany, unquote, is one which Theo Sonziger, president of the DFB, the German Football Federation, brings to his foreword to The Ball is Colorful, which is a volume edited by historian Dietelm Blecking and author and museum curator Gerd Dembowski. And the book was actually published with financial support from the German Football Federation. The DFB's relationship with multiculturalism is a bit trickier in my mind. Dembowski, actually, one of the editors, was a curator of a 2001 traveling exhibition called Tatortstadion, so Crime Scene Stadium, from which the DFB abruptly withdrew its promised support after its support was opened up to criticism in the media. So Zwanziger's characterization of multiculturalism as a new thing in Germany and something which the DFB has supported is inaccurate. It is understandable, however, that Zwanziger says what he says, as it absolves the DFB of any need to do anything to foster integration if the game itself does the heavy lifting. This volume addresses kind of these questions that Zwanziger raises, and in some ways supporting and in other ways complicating his ideas. So it raises questions like, how has German football been influenced and inflected by ethnic and national diversity? What are the legacies of these influences and inflections on this renewed interest in multiculturalism in football in the 2000s? Is football somehow this cosmopolitan world which kind of guarantees a peaceful cooperation between people of different ethnic and religious groups? Or is football kind of an area of exceptions, which are kind of, I guess, blocked off from quote-unquote real life? So the editors bring together a number of short interviews and overviews on the history of diversity in football in Germany, as well as short and, in my mind, not particularly illuminating interviews with current footballers and trainers, including current and former national team members like Mesut Özil, Patrick Omeyala, and Bundesliga trainers like Mirko Slomka. These interviews should not be taken to reflect an overall focus on the part of the book on only the highest levels of German football, where figures like Özil and Omeyala are accorded great symbolic weight in media discourse, but the authors also devote a great deal of attention to lower levels and unorganized football, amateur football, street football, and there's only one article on the women's game. In the interest of time, I'll just highlight a few of what I consider to be particularly useful contributions to the edited volume. So the authors highlight a lot of early pioneers of football in Germany. There's a very interesting article on by Bernd Bayer on Walter Benzemann, a Jewish pioneer of football in Germany who co-founded Kicker, the leading sport magazine in Germany, and to my mind, the source of the most useful player ratings in Europe, better than they keeps. So Benzemann saw football as a medium for cultural understanding against reactionary nationalism, certainly something that was prevalent in sport at the time that he was active in the early 20th century. So Bayer's piece is among the most valuable because it doesn't present that presume there's sort of this particular inherent cosmopolitan element in the Benzemann's enthusiastic adoption of football as a vehicle for cultural change. Football was just kind of convenient because it was a sport that hadn't, like, for example, gymnastics, already been kind of colonized by nationalist, chauvinistic, and anti-Semitic groups. Another particularly useful article is one by Gerd Dembowski on Polish and Turkish organization. So clubs organized among Polish workers in the Ruhr region of Germany in the early 19th century and 20th century, the early 20th century, as well as Turkish organization after the 1960s. It really raises some interesting questions about how we take into account self-organization in discussions of integration. So, do we see this as a force keeping migrants separate from the outside world, or by virtue of organizing migrants into teams, which are of course integrated into the pyramid structure of German football, does it also have kind of an integrative effect? What I found most interesting, I think, was the short article by Günter Gebauer, a German philosopher, who identifies a kind of new, what I would consider neoliberal trend in football. So the trend towards a flexible sort of citizenship in which a valued potential national team player like for example, Mesut Özil, can be taken to be the sort of elite, highly trained migrant that Germany is attempting to recruit. So a migrant like Mesut Özil, but rather the child of migrants like Mesut Özil, is privileged by virtue of what he can bring to Germany and what his talents can bring to Germany. So in conclusion, this volume is particularly useful in arguing against the idea that Germany is not a country of immigration. This is a fairly pernicious idea that's nevertheless persisted in Germany for many years. These articles point to a long history of immigration in football and general social associational life in Germany. It's hard to show, however, and this volume doesn't show in my view, to what extent these echoes can be interpreted. So these echoes of an earlier era, particularly Polish and Jewish associational football organization in the early 20th century, to what extent these echoes can be interpreted as anything but coincidental. So the ways in which Polish and Jewish football was discussed in similar ways to this current discussion about multiculturalism in football in Germany. It's hard to know whether these are echoes that are purely coincidental or if they say something in particular about Germany's relationship with difference and sport. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Brian. We have roughly 3 minutes for questions because we still have several authors that are here to report. So let's keep this short and sweet. If anyone has questions, nothing is appearing on the screen, but anybody? Okay, if not, let's move on then. Ruani Sibaha, you are next. And then Christopher Gaffney, Rio, and then Liz Timms back in East Lansing. Ruani.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, great. So I had a book that came out recently on a sports journalist in Argentina named Dante Panzeri. Panzeri, at least through my research, mostly in the different archives of sports journalist school in Buenos Aires, it always seemed to be sort of this mythic, legendary figure among sports journalists. And so as I started developing my own research, he seemed to be somebody that it was worth paying attention to. What I didn't realize was how much of a part of my own work he was eventually going to become. And I wish I was with, I guess, Alex in Buenos Aires. They had a session not too long ago at River Plate Museum on Panzeri that was that the author Matthias Bausa was one of the panelists. So it'd been great to at least maybe I'll have to find out what was said at that session. But this book is the first treatment of this journalist and who worked mostly in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s until he passed away right before the 78 World Cup. The book does make a good job making the case for why Panzeri is worth paying attention to. He was a prolific author. He was, like I said, influential for sports journalists, but he also had a very unique voice that's been very hard to replicate. And Bausa also makes a good case for why this book is needed, mostly because little is known about him personally. Most of it's known through his writing. So he smartly doesn't stop at what's really the pinnacle of Panzeri's career, which was working at the sports magazine El Gráfico. And actually was able to find some radio transcripts, some of his work in newspapers and popular magazines, as well as the two books that Panzeri himself published. Bausa's book really is more, it's mostly excerpts and reproductions of some of Panzeri's work. But he does provide an opening chapter in which he chooses some of the pieces and explains some of the pieces that are in this book that hit upon the recurring themes in Panzeri's work and his different approaches to sports writing, his use of humor, his critical eye, and mostly his denouncements. Panzeri he ruffled everybody's feathers. He did not make a lot of friends. And he was a sports journalist who really was convicted that there was a right way to play sports and to see sports and really saw the world in black and white. So Bausa actually starts off the book basically simply saying Dante Panzeri era un cabrón. He was a jackass. He had a complicated character. He was, among other things, hard-headed, implacable, rigid, somewhat dogmatic, obsessive, and difficult to get along with. His obsessions seemed to be manias. And I think that in many ways that does sum up who this Panzeri figure is. He really felt that there was too much corruption, too much excess, particularly among politicians. This led a lot of people to accuse him of being an anti-Peronist, of fact that but Panzeri's anti-Peronism wasn't necessarily politically motivated. It was really his disgust at the excesses the state had in influencing Argentine sports, because he was just as critical of some of the governments that came after Perón. After this brief introduction, we get into, it's actually a pretty long introduction. We get into the thematic sections of the book in which we see Panzeri's words for himself. And he hits upon some of the main things that Panzeri kept talking about, particularly his vision about how soccer should be played. He makes a case, of course, that Panzeri would have loved seeing this Barcelona and this Spain national team and its obsession with the ball. He idolized, not idolized, because I don't think Panzeri idolized anybody, but he really admired Cesar Luis Menotti even before he became a coach and as a player, and found that he and Menotti saw the game the same way. Obviously, he was very critical of the other side of Argentine soccer at the time, particularly Estudiantes and their approach during the 1960s. The reason why I think this book is useful, first of all, like I said, for my own study, it's helpful because Panzeri's voice gives us an understanding of the debates in Argentine soccer at the time. But it also gives us a kind of a window to some of the social anxieties that middle-class professionals like Panzeri expressed. And the way they're able to use sort of a cultural view or prism to digest soccer, to see that soccer was just more than what was being played on the field. And as sports scholars, I think a lot of times when we look at sports magazines, we focus on the players and the coaches and the sports officials. Or even we cite the tendencies of certain publications. But sometimes we fail to go deeper and examine that within a publication like El Gráfico. There were various voices that didn't necessarily see eye to eye, and that the role of the sports journalist in shaping the narrative is oftentimes jarring when you get a chance to actually look at the match footage and see something sometimes different. This really stood out to me watching the England-Argentina game in 1966 and then comparing it to the narratives. Just sort of to sum up, because I know we're short on time, I think that Balso's book is typical of a lot of books published in Argentina by journalists. It's a little bit fawning towards Panzeri. It's sort of low on the historical context. But at the same time, this is a sports writer who, as opposed to other ones, really stood out in terms of shaping the language and the narratives and the debates of the time. And so in this sense, I thought that it was very useful. Balso did mention that he interviewed Panzeri's family. I don't feel he did enough of those interviews, which would have been beneficial. I think he could have also interviewed some of the colleagues that are still alive, players and referees, particularly those who were targets of Panzeri's articles. But overall, I do like the fact that he let Panzeri's words speak for themselves, and I guess that's about it. Other than just really, I think the main sense I get out of this is that Panzeri remains mythical to sports journalists because he was not a sellout. He was not afraid to say what was on his mind, and even if that really got him in trouble with editors and with politicians and club officials.
Excellent. Thank you, Ruani. Good transition from Dante Panzeri in Buenos Aires to Mario Filho in Rio de Janeiro. Christopher Gaffney.
Thanks, Peter. And nice to be back on Football Scholars after such a long absence. This book, O Negro no Futebol Brasileiro, the Black in Brazilian Football, is considered one of the great classics of Brazilian football journalism written by one of the great figures in football journalism, Mario Puyol. But, and I wanted to bring it back, bring it to this discussion for a couple of reasons. One was to really look at it as a more of a narrative fiction or narrative nonfiction that is more of a romance than a piece of investigative journalism, because there it's 315 pages or so, and there are nearly no references in the book, so it can't really be considered much of a history book in that sense. But I also wanted to think about it in terms of my own reading of this 10 years after having first encountered it, now that I've been living in Brazil for the last 5 years, and looking at the myths and the susceptibility of people coming into an unknown situation to believe in the myths that are put forth by people like Mario Puyol. The basic narrative of the book is that is trying to overturn, one is that Mario Puyol's goal was to overturn this narrative of blacks being responsible for the defeat of the Brazilian team in 1950, and to suggest that Brazilian football was great because of its black players. Of course, this book came out after Brazil had won the World Cup in 1958 and 1962. And so it was kind of a valorization of the role of the black player in Brazilian football history. But it had a very intentional project behind it, and that Mario Filho was looking to valorize something that he didn't necessarily have to be a part of. And what I mean by that is that Mario Filho, as a white person of privilege, was consolidating the role of the black player within a kind of a subaltern world of football employee, and not one that would actually ever be in control of the game. And so it was a sort of a way of maintaining black subalternity in the Brazilian footballing context. In my own reading of this, when I was first doing my research, it was very, I was enchanted by the idea that that football was a place in Brazil where blacks and mulattoes and poor whites could actually find social mobility, especially in clubs like Vasco da Gama. The longer I've been in Brazil, the more I've come to realize that that's not necessarily the case, and that the propagation of these myths, both by Brazilians who are within the football context, by people who believe in these myths of the club, and by the kind of the unquestioning reverence of people like Mario Filho, really does a lot to hide deeper meanings within there. And so it's very much been an interesting process for me to realize that my initial readings of this were perhaps too superficial as someone that was looking for information in foreign context, coming in as a foreigner to Brazil, looking for basic information and being told that this is one of the great books, and perhaps going with the narrative of Mario Filho a bit too ingenuously. And I think that this has really been a lesson, because I was not trained as a historian. I think it's something that we should, as foreign researchers in context, or any kind of researcher, even Brazilians have gotten this story somewhat wrong over the years, that we really need to be attentive to the ideological perspectives behind people like Mario Filho, who was very much involved in the political scene in Brazil in the 1940s and 1950s. He was very much an actor. He used his journalistic credentials and his newspaper presence as political instruments to get what he wanted. And one of these things was the building of the Maracanã Stadium in the place where it was. And he was going against, at the time, Carlos Lacerda, who would eventually be a major figure in the right and one of the primary figures of the Brazilian dictatorship in the 60s, who wanted to have the stadium right now where the Olympic site is in Barra da Tijuca. And so after this, after Mario Filho's death in 1966, the Maracanã Stadium, which used to be called the Estádio Municipal de Rio de Janeiro, was renamed in his honor, and it will be the site of the final of the World Cup. And so I think, similar to Santiago Bernabeu, it's good that we analyze the names and the social trajectories behind the people whom these, for whom these famous stadiums are named, and the trajectory of Mar del Filho as much to do with the political situation in Brazil as it does with his fame for having written this book about Brazilian football history.
Great. Thank you, Christopher. We come back to East Lansing with Liz Timms.
Hi, everyone. So I decided to look at an edited volume put together by Peter Leggi and Chris Boltzmann called South Africa and the Global Game, Football, Apartheid, and Beyond. It was published in 2010, first as a special edition of Soccer and Society. And I wanted to look at this volume kind of as a state of the field of football in South Africa, how it's being studied, not just from a historical standpoint, but really an interdisciplinary volume with a lot of different approaches. And the intent of the volume was, quote, to show how football offers a rich vein for further analysis on a number of important topics and themes. And the topics and themes that this volume was meant to show were about how football can be used to uncover fresh insights into colonialism, segregation, apartheid, and the struggle for liberation, as well as connecting the South African game to larger historical processes. And the volume contains 12 essays. I can't cover all of them, unfortunately, but in general, they cover a wide range of topics. And then these are really connected to the broader literature on sports history in South Africa and broader historical processes in the nation of South Africa, historical change over time, through interdisciplinary approaches. Again, I think that's a really key part of this volume. Like I said, there's 12 articles. I can't cover all of them. Instead, I'd like to look at three key themes which emerged that I think offer both insights into the game in South Africa as well as spaces for future research. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the 2010 World Cup. This volume was published in 2010, so there were a number of selections devoted to the World Cup 4, to be more specific. Two in particular I wanted to focus on because I really haven't seen arguments like theirs presented in other academic forums. Sifiso Njlovu's Sports as Cultural Diplomacy really stands out. He's talking about Pan-Africanism in the World Cup, not only as a tool for an emotional connection, which is a lot of the way that it's talked about, or just for garnering votes in FIFA to get the bid, but part of a broader sports diplomacy in South African history and as part of the political terrain of South Africa. I thought that was a really great piece. Ashwin Desai and Ghulam Vahed's piece, World Cup 2010, Africa's Turn or the Turn on Africa, also deals with the Pan-African logic that pervaded the bids for the tournament. But it also looked at the promises that were made about how the tournament would benefit South Africa. And their argument is that looking at the tournament this way, quote, is the perfect opportunity to bring the politics and economics of soccer back into the public domain. And so looking at them now, it'd be interesting to see how they would spin it 4 years later with another World Cup on the horizon with similar kind of promises made. Another theme that I really thought came out particularly strong in this volume was about football fandom. And three of the essays in the volume really deal with how football fandom in South Africa is shaped by race, by media influences, and by lingering divisions in the South African sporting landscape, particularly between rugby and soccer, and how this kind of makes fandom in South Africa a tense arena. There's a piece by Mark Fletcher, which I think is really great, talking about an ethnographic approach to studying fandom in South Africa, looking at three teams in particular, and he really kind of delves into the racial politics of fandom in South Africa, not only for South African teams, but also South African fans of English teams. Also, Sean Jacobs has a piece in this, It Wasn't That I Did Not Like South African Football, which really, for me, complicated my understanding of South African fandom, and he talks about the influence of global media in shifting his loyalties from South African clubs to Liverpool football clubs. And so it really shows how this is such a rich field of study. And the final thing that really, really stuck out for me was the selections in this volume about player migration. Paul Darby and Eric Solberg have a piece comparing South African and Ghanaian patterns of player migration, which really starts to show why South Africa doesn't participate in the global football migration the way that other nations do. And also, Peter has a piece in this on Darius Lomo, which is really a micro history of this one player and how he navigated the global sporting world. And it really this microapproach really shows the need for more studies of this type, not just to rescue these figures from kind of historical amnesia, but also to problematize what we know about South African sports migration, how individuals experience it. And so, yeah, like I said, there's a lot in this volume, some pieces better than others, but I think it opens up a lot of doors for more work, in particular, maybe on the women's game. There's one piece in this volume, and sadly that's more of a trend in the literature on soccer in South Africa for women's sports to not get the same attention as men's. Yeah, so that's where I'm.
Great. Unless there are any questions from the audience, and if you do have questions, please ask them now. We will move to the last group in the list. Any questions? No? Okay. Let's go to Ben Detmar and Javier Pescador, and then Austin Long will be present via a MP3 recording that he sent along. How cool is that? Okay, Ben, turn it over to you.
Hey, how y'all doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, great, thanks. Yep.
Sorry, I was just checking. All right, so kind of like everybody else, I was waiting for these all these books on Brazil to come out that we've been talking about in the messages here. I even tried to email some publishers to get advance copies, but I don't think we're quite far along enough yet to get those. So I picked a book on Australian soccer, and I know very little about Australian soccer, which is kind of the reason I picked that. It's a series of edited essays called The Containment of Soccer in Australia. And it's really useful for people to want to discover how to grow soccer in a country where soccer is perhaps not the biggest sport. And that's what I found most useful out of it. Especially as there's a lot of similarities to the US, especially in terms of the battle between getting soccer away from just being a sport of the ethnic groups and more into the mainstream. And we've talked about this in the Football Scholars Forum before. The US soccer mom phenomenon, but not getting the ethnic groups involved. I mean, even for those of us in East Lansing, we play in soccer leagues that are pretty white for the most part and that don't go into the Hispanic population. And this is something that Australia struggled with as well. So I'll just look at a couple of the chapters too. Daniel Locke has a great chapter on the A-League and on the way the A-League tried to change this in Australia, and he surveyed the fans and tried to discover if bringing fans together worked, and it seems like it did. And the A-League tried to get the ethnic groups involved by having initially just one team per city, and therefore forcing everybody to watch one team. So for a city like Melbourne, for example, which is the often seen as the sports capital of Australia, and people there will say it's the sports capital of the world. So it's very important that soccer was embraced in Melbourne. By having initially just one team there, it kind of forced people to support the regional team rather than the ethnic groups there. This is something that's similar to what the MLS did as well, certainly originally. Had one team in each city and then slowly tried to build other teams in there, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. As we'll see, the Chivas disaster in Los Angeles, for example, didn't really work. But they're trying to get two teams in New York now, so we'll see if that works. It kind of happened in Melbourne too. A second team was added a few years after the league originated to try and get more of a rivalry in there, but not have that rivalry be ethnic based. There's also an interesting chapter in here for me, who's studied a lot about U.S. soccer, on David Beckham and on kind of the Beckham effect of soccer in Australia. It's a little bit old hat maybe to talk about David Beckham now, and the chapter in the volume, it talks about David Beckham and his metrosexuality and how that affected Australian soccer. It seemed a little bit about talking about MySpace as opposed to Facebook or something. It's a little bit old-fashioned. But it was interesting in how Beckham apparently was very, very important in pushing soccer in Australia and in making soccer the popular sport that it now is in Australia. A discussion of Beckham as this postmodern icon who brought new fans to the game, got women involved in the game, got men who previously were not interest in soccer, maybe not interest in sport involved in the game. She talks a lot about a former socceroo, one of the Australian national team, whose autobiography was called, quote, Sheila's Wogs and Pufters, end quote. And that this was seen as the basis for the game in the US, in Australia, sorry, this kind of small subgroup of people. David Beckham kind of helped bring some into the industry, and the brand Beckham is talked about a lot there. And we see that too, a lot in the US. Really interesting. Beckham also helped to bring soccer into he seemed more as a British sport rather than an epic sport in Australia. And this helps a lot. And the Australians love nothing more than beating the British at sport. So sports like cricket and rugby, and netball, these sports where Australia are some of the best in the world and traditionally beat the British teams. This is seen as being something, you know, something that's good. And so when Beckham helps to grow the Premier League or Manchester United, and this sort of thing, it helps take soccer out of these Callum Gilmore have a great chapter on television viewing of soccer in Australia. And this is really interesting, I think, for people who want to see how to grow the game in the US. As a little kind of side note, I follow the Columbus Crew Soccer in Major League Soccer. And they recently signed a deal with Time Warner, which hardly anybody has, especially in Ohio, hardly anybody has it. And it also ensures that soccer is blacked out on MLS Live, which is the website where people can subscribe and watch MLS games. You know, we're 20 years into the MLS now, and people are still making mistakes with having soccer on TV. And Rowan Gilmore talked a lot about how Australia also followed this, certainly in the early years. In Australia, a lot of sport is protected by the government, and it's... The same thing is true in the UK. But soccer never got this protection. And Rowan Gilmore see this as being something that hurts soccer. Certainly originally hurt soccer within the US. It was this minority sport, and it was on a minority channel. But when it was on free-to-air TV, it got a lot of viewers. For example, 40% of Australians watched Australia lose to Italy in 2006 in the World Cup. But they didn't really learn this lesson, is what Rowan Gilmore is saying. And soccer continued to struggle to get TV viewers because it didn't get this protection, because it was seen as this ethnic sport, because it was seen as this new sport, because it wasn't seen as a sport of the mainstream. And it'd be really interesting. This season, a new TV deal was worked out that saw soccer actually be on free-to-air television for the first time. So it'll be interesting to see if this works out and if Rowan Gilmore's thesis about soccer being on free-to-air TV is what is needed to take it into the next step, if you will, to make it more and more popular. So it's 4:29, so I'll kind of wrap up. But it's clear that, I mean, there's 12 chapters in this volume, and some of them have differing opinions of what Australia needs to do to stop soccer being the fenced off sport. But it's really interesting if you want to look at other major countries where soccer perhaps isn't the most popular sport, on how to grow it, and on getting big stars in, and on ensuring it's on free-to-air television, and ensuring that the teams that are created, it's a really look at growing up the game in a country that isn't perhaps as soccer mad as some of the places we've been talking about. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Ben. We, at least here in East Lansing, we had trouble picking up quite a bit of what you were saying. Okay, sorry about that. The final live report will come from Professor Javier Pescador, I assume, in Ann Arbor. Take it away.
Okay, thank you. There is a story in Mexico City named Futbolología, and it's the store is placed in a residential apartment. It's basically a cyber store that specializes in books on soccer. So every time I go to Mexico City, I visit this store, Futbolología, and I spend like a lot of time there because they have books from Argentina, they have books from Italy, they have books from Spain. And even though their market is based on selling like coffee table books for soccer fans, they also have scholar books that are published in other parts. They also have a website. You can have access to that website, and they are like a mini Amazon.com company in the sense that they ship books to wherever you are if you want to pay the money. So I'm telling this story because last time I went to Mexico City, I was in this store, Futbología, and I was looking at different books on the history of different Mexican clubs. And one of the sources that most of them quote and get the information from is a book from 1960 named The Golden Book of Mexican Soccer. Right? This is an encyclopedia of Mexican soccer published in 1960 by a guy named Cid E. Mulet. So I asked in this Futbología store about this book, and they have it, and they said they didn't have it, but they could look for it. And I asked again, and then they got tired, so I didn't get anywhere. So I started to look for this book in used bookstores in Mexico City. And finally, on the last day I was in Mexico City, I could find a copy of this golden book on Mexican soccer. And I was trying to get an access to it just like everybody else, to, you know, grab information from it and use it as a primary source, right? Because that's basically how we look at the old books from previous decades on soccer, right? We don't really look at them with a lot of respect. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to present on this particular book, because after reading it, I was very surprised by the perspective, or the analytical perspective of the author on the development of soccer in Mexico. So the common mythology in the history of Mexican soccer is that the Mexicans started to play soccer after they watched the British doing it in their mining companies, in their commercial enterprises, in their different activities, leisure activities as immigrants in Mexico in the 1880s and 1890s, and that at some point Mexicans started to learn the game and then learn how to defeat the British at their own game, right? And that's the common mythology in the history of Mexican soccer that is repeated in the following decades with the presence or the massive presence of Spanish refugees from the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. However, this book is far from presenting, even though it's not a history book, it has a lot of pictures, has a lot of information about the factual development of matches, tournaments, and seasons. This book has a completely different approach. The book is basically dedicated to the two British individuals that brought soccer into the country in the 1880s and 1890s. One of them is Percy Clifford and the other one, Robert Blackmore. And the book dedicates a lot of attention to the development of British, Spanish, German, and even French clubs in Mexico. And it shows sort of the continuity between these clubs and the formation of Mexican clubs, right? For instance, when talking about one of the founders, Mr. Percy Clifford, he comes to Mexico as an employee, participates in the mercantile activities of the British in Mexico. He's the founder. He's a member of the British Cricket Club in Mexico. He's the founder of some of the first soccer clubs in the area, but he's also a coach. Well, later on in the 1910s and 1920s, he participates as a coach for Spanish and then Mexican football teams, right? So this is a guy who is an immigrant and all of a sudden becomes sort of acquainted or involved or engaged with the formation of clubs that appear to be ethnic but also have this inclusiveness to allow a British subject as the coach or as the member or as the founder. So in this way, they have a completely different approach on how to look at soccer, because what I
got from Sidney Mulet is that he's looking into the personal biographies of individuals that stay for a long period of time in this, in Mexico in this case, and have a profound impact on the development not only of the British clubs, but also of other clubs that are not British or that were formed after the British era that came to an end basically in 1914, but that they stay and participated in different capacities in the formation of all these different clubs. In doing so, the author, Sid Imulet, also provides a lot of information about the continuity or the bloodlines between Spanish clubs or so-called Spanish clubs and Mexican clubs. In many cases, members from Spanish families participated in both Spanish clubs and in Mexican clubs. So, as Peter Allegi was stating in his review of the Barça versus Real Madrid book, there is a lot of nuances that we miss when we take, you know, at face value the stereotypical representations of soccer as essentializing representations of either ethnicity, nationality, or immigrant status. And in doing so, I think we're missing a lot of information and processes that are really worth to look at, right? For instance, when Alex Galarza is talking about how soccer clubs articulated social and recreational life in Buenos Aires in the 1930s, I was just looking at the index again of this book, and they were, these Spanish, British, and Mexican clubs were doing exactly the same in terms of using the club not only to anchor the community social life, but also to anchor the recreational and leisure activities in the afterward. So I found a lot of similarities between this book and some of the books that we'll review. And I also concur with Chris that these books, the classic books on the history of soccer, should be reviewed or should be evaluated against the background of historical research. And that's what I wanted to get from this book. I was very, very surprised, very pleasantly surprised by the way in which this author sort of refuses to participate in this national mythology by which soccer is the place in which foreigners and Mexicans come together so that the Mexicans can win and finally achieve, you know, international status or international recognition from the athletic achievements in the soccer field. So I'm going to leave it like that so that we can have some final moments in for the participation of the entire group.
Gracias, Javier. And now I will play the 3-minute clip that Austin sent with his report of the final book on the list, which is the book This Love Is Not for Cowards, Salvation and Soccer in Ciudad Juarez by Robert Andrew Powell.
I recently read This Love Is Not for Cowards by Robert Andrew Powell. A while ago, I listened to a podcast in which the author discussed the premise of the book, and I was intrigued. Intrigued enough to have it on my wish list for over 2 years, but never pulled the trigger. The Mexican premier didn't quite have the juice of tactics and history of the European clubs, but the leader of our local supporters group suggested the book for our book review, and this was the impetus I needed to buy it. Powell took an amazing risk embedding himself in Juarez for several months. His account of the dangers of simple daily life were startling, making me wonder how anyone could survive day in and day out in that environment. Time and again, he relayed the attitude of the city residents who, in the face of overwhelming circumstances, pushed on, creating normal life in an absurd context. The Indios climbed from obscurity to the top division of Mexican soccer, hung in there, and survived a dramatic playoff run to maintain their top-flight status in 2009. However, the 2009-2010 season was awful, with the team setting a record for the longest winless streak in Mexican history, and their futility saw them all but relegated early in the season. To make matters worse, players were not even being paid by the end of their campaign. And really, the football was secondary to this book. Powell used his unique placement to inform the readers about the totally different opportunities and environments separated by only a fence. The atmospheres in El Paso and Juarez were miles apart, which the author put into context by looking from high vantage points into each city and wondering just how this could be. I give Powell a lot of credit for jumping in with both feet. From living in the city, the new murder capital of the world, joining the supporters group El Cartel for a road trip, engaging the team on an almost daily basis, home and away, developing relationships with the players, families, and fans, getting involved and participating in the good and bad aspects of life in Juarez. The book is depressing but hard to put down. As a cultural and sporting examination, I thought it was quite good and well worth reading. Aaron Passman is the leader of Mid-Michigan United, and we sat down a couple of weeks ago to discuss the book. He brought a couple of points forward, which I thought were kind of interesting. He mentioned that the supporters adopted almost a hooligan mentality, which I thought, while these days it seems like that the image of supporters has been sanitized, there's much more focus on family and support rather than the drinking and fighting culture of years gone by. Aaron also wondered what it might look like if a similar story was written using Detroit as the base camp, something using DCSC, Detroit City Football Club, as a team that you follow, and then what's going on in downtown Detroit every day. For me, I found it strange that there were bodies littered all over where the author would run as part of his fitness regimen. He would read about a death, and then inevitably, on his run that day, he would have to run right by that spot. Again, the football was secondary, and the club was so poorly run that the club actually folded shortly after the book was written. I would really enjoy an epilogue from the author, having him go back into the city with the club gone, and what, if anything, had changed from the days he was there to life beyond the Indios. Again, a book worth reading. It's excellent cultural study, and highly recommend it.
Okay, that was Austin Long reporting, and that completes our State of the Field session. Alex, are you still there in the bar in Buenos Aires, or the cafe, I should say?
I am still in the cafe, yeah.
Okay, do you have a few words there?
I just wanted to say thank you for everyone for taking time out to not only read these works, but to put a lot of thought into the audience that would be receiving it, and especially Javier and Andrew, like looking at these books as a way of adding to a conversation that we're having as football scholars. You know, thanks in particular to you guys, but thanks to everyone for taking the time out to make a special contribution to the group. And I got a ton out of this, and you know, with more time and focus, I think we could do even more interesting things with this type of format. And thanks goes to Peter and Peter's mother, I guess I should say, for suggesting it.
Yes, I should give the shout out to Mom, who said, you know, why doesn't your book club try a different format once in a while? This is what we did at my book club. So thanks, Mom. Also, you know, we're going to meet in person in just a couple of weeks on Long Island. So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. And FSF has a roundtable scheduled for the conference at Hofstra. So look for plenty of emails in the next few days regarding the conference, regarding our roundtable. And it'll be great to see you all in person. And hopefully we'll get to play some football and maybe even pass the ball around with the king himself, Pelé. All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Ciao.